I should begin with some more thanks initially to the to our organisers of the conference. Sorry I've missed so much of it. and particularly to Alex Wilkes, who stepped into the breach when I wasn't able to give my talk on Thursday. That was very kind of him. Okay, so my talk today is rather different in flavour from most of those I think we've been hearing. So I'm not going to be presenting a reconstruction of quantum mechanics, and there isn't, I don't think, a jot of mathematics in the presentation today. What I want to do is do a little bit of conceptual investigation of one particular approach to thinking about the reconstructive project, of course, an approach, quantum Bayesianism, which we've already heard from Chris about. This approach, which he's developed along with Carl Caves and Rudiger Schark. Chris, of course, is one of our esteemed chairmen, is one of the most vociferous, or perhaps persuasive, proponents of the idea that a revealing axiomatic reformulation of quantum mechanics will be found from a quantum information flavored direction. And what I want to look at is the interpretation of quantum mechanics that goes behind this idea. So in the quantum Bayesians approach to the elucidation of the structure of quantum theory, its reformulation in some conceptually revealing terms, the approach begins with taking a particular interpretive stance towards quantum mechanics. So it's not that one looks at the bare structure and reformulates it and then thinks about what interpretational consequences might follow. Rather, the approach is to say, right, I think this is the right way of thinking about quantum mechanics. Now let me sort out the junk from the real stuff and see where the physically interesting facts lie. And what I want to look at is that interpretational stance and see whether we think it holds up. Because for many, it's far too radical a proposal, and that might make them want to get off the reconstructive train straight away. But what I want to do today is argue that, well, I'm not going to deny that it's a radical proposal, but what I want to do is present what I take to be the conceptual underpinnings of the approach. Chris may disagree that they are indeed the kind of thing he exactly had in mind, but this is the way that I think about what Chris wants to do. I want to defend the approach from certain rather weak objections which are very commonly made to it. And then I want to go into some of the more substantive issues that I think raise problems for the approach. We'll see how much time exactly we have to get through those. So I want to explain the position, see what's good about it, dispose of some weak objections, and then these here are the more substantive concerns. What's the ontology that's supposed to go along with the quantum Bayesian position? What happens with the notion of explanation in the quantum domain if we take this kind of approach? And finally, there's something I call the means-ends objection. I have a worry that if one takes the quantum Bayesian stance, then it becomes opaque how the means of our inquiries into the world could lead to the ends that we desire. We'll probably miss this one out of a running short of time. Okay. So, of course, you already heard the outline, the basics of the approach. In a nutshell, here it is again. So the idea of the quantum Bayesians of the Caves, Fuchs, Shark stripe, particular stripe, is that a quantum state represents an agent's degrees of belief about what the outcome of measurements will be and nothing more. And crucially, and this is the really strong subjective Bayesian element of the approach, these are purely subjective judgments. They're not matters of fact. They're in no way responsive to facts about how the world is. Then, as a matter of consistency in the approach, they're going to require that quantum operations and POVM elements are subjective too. So the POVM elements we associate with the outcomes of some measurement procedure, that's not an objective matter of fact, that's a matter of judgment. Also not responsive to facts about how the world is. And the time evolutions in quantum mechanics, again, how we think states evolve, that's not determined by how the world is, it's determined by what our thoughts about it are. Sure. Good question. I don't want to spend too much time on it. So, Well, I don't actually. There's a lot of interesting stuff here, and I'm sort of tempted to go off into aesthetics. But I mean, we can give a positive characterization of what it means here rather than the contrastive characterization, which would be the one that would be harder. So here I just mean that these are judgments which aren't right or wrong in virtue of how the world is. Of course, there might be other notions of objectivity other than right or wrong in virtue of how the world is, particularly in various domains of inquiry, such as aesthetic or moral. But I don't want to get into that. Okay. Now, the question is, why should we think like this? I mean, this is a quite powerfully unusual way of thinking about quantum mechanics, of thinking about physical formalisms in general. Well, we'll see, and we'll explain further in a little bit. First, I want to give some very quick reminders on probability. This, I guess, is actually going to be totally familiar to everyone in the room, so this is just partly for terminology. So when we're thinking about probabilities, there's one fundamental dichotomy we need to deal with. It's the distinction between objective or subjective probabilities, or subjective and objective theories of probability, theories of the nature of probability. Classical, well, standard objectivist views, theories of probability, there's the so-called classical interpretations of probability which appeal to principles of indifference to set what the probabilities are. This is one of the earliest, that's why it's called the classical, this is one of the earliest accounts of probability. Particularly popular in the 20th century, frequentist accounts of probability, analyses of probability in terms of relative frequencies, perhaps in an infinite limit which is never instantiated. I guess a sort of a mid-20th century innovation, propensity ideas of probability began with Popper, was more usefully developed by people like Meller in a rather different way. And propensity interpretations are the antecedents of a kind of a Lewisian theory of objective chance, where chances are those things, those objective matters of fact in the world, which did one but no one would constrain one's subjective degrees of belief in certain kinds of ways. So those are objective theories of probability. Now, on the subjective side, we have the familiar idea that really probability statements aren't about objective matters of fact at all. They're expressions of one's degrees of belief. Sometimes this is sometimes called personalism. That's a Savage's term, or simply Bayesianism. Two components, of course, to this, a synchronic and a diachronic one. First of all, we have an argument that degrees of belief have to satisfy the probability axioms so long as one's believer is suitably rational. So as long as they don't commit themselves to a Dutch book, that is a sequence of bets which would lead to a sure loss, whatever the outcome is, then one's degrees of belief are going to satisfy the probability calculus. That's a strong and interesting result. Then we have the diachronic component, which says that one ought to update one's degrees of belief on evidence by Bayes' theorem, and this is where the Bayesian name comes from. Now, people have given various arguments for this diachronic component of the position. They're not as strong as these arguments here. They're quite persuasive. They're quite natural arguments to say that one ought to update one's degrees of belief in this kind of way, but they tend to bring in some empirical components at some point. So unlike this synchronic argument, it's not a purely logical argument, although often a persuasive one. Okay. Within Bayesianism, finally, we have distinctions which have been sort of floating around, I guess, this week to some extent, which is distinctions between objective Bayesianism and subjective Bayesianism. The most famous objective Bayesian was Ed James, and the idea here is that there are objective constraints on priors, and here by objective I mean worldly constraints on priors, facts about the world, often about the symmetries of the system one's looking at, are supposed to provide a constraint on what the prior one should have is. Contrary-wise, we have the subjective Bayesians, and they go the whole hog. They say there are absolutely no worldly constraints on priors. These are just my degrees of belief. They're what are in my head. They aren't right or wrong in virtue of anything about how the world is. Did I say worthy? Oh, yeah.
Oh, but you said worthy.
Worldly.
Award.
Thanks, yeah, thanks, actually, that's excellent. that's actually very funny, so I've missed that all the way through. Good, thanks, Howard. Yeah, that was a Freudian slip. This should be worldly constraints.
My career is built on giving worldly.
Right. Now, of course, with this kind of free-for-all going on, we need to have some account of why, in fact, to all appearances, most everyday practice involving probabilities looks as if everyone agrees on what the probabilities are, as if they were objective matters of fact. And here the Bayesian is going to come up with, or the subjectivist Bayesian is going to come up with some theorem, most famously the Definetti kinds of theorems, which tell us how people starting out with different priors tend to get pushed towards having the same priors on receipt of evidence. Thus, we can't simply point to, the idea is we can't simply point to practice in the lab or where have you, in order to say that no, probabilities must be objective, because the Bayesian, in light of these theorems, would say, well, look, no, I've got an account which says how we can explain why everyone thinks the same, or tends to think the same, notwithstanding the fact that there's no facts, as it were, forcing them to think the same. There's no facts about what the probabilities are which they're tracking. Okay. I mean, that I take it all pretty familiar. Why should we extend this kind of view to the quantum realm? Well, one straightforward kind of reason is just that if one thinks that a subjective Bayesian account of probability really is the only intelligible account of probability, and we note that quantum mechanics is, of course, a probabilistic theory in some sense, then you're going to have to say that, well, quantum probabilities have got to be subjective too. That's, as it were, being hard-headed about one's interpretation of probability. But there's another kind of angle we can take on this question of why one should be a quantum Bayesian. And we can explore that by exploring a little fable about scientific progression, a way one could think about how science could or might have progressed. So we'll start off with, I take it to be a generally agreed, at least by all sensible people, a generally agreed proposition about the world and about science. So the world exists, mind and agent, independently, and the aim of science is to find out about it, straightforwardly. If that's the aim of science, to find out about the world, then the theories that mature scientific theories, anyway, the theories that mature science postulates are going to need not only to predict how things will be when we perform experiments, but they also need to actually be descriptive. They need to tell us about the world, tell us what's in it, and tell us how it behaves. And because they're descriptive, they can be explanatory. They can explain why we see the things that interest us around us. And why we see the phenomena we do. Now, I take it that by and large, physics has been largely successful in giving us such descriptive and explanatory theories. But now let's suppose that at some point we run into the buffers. Okay, so we carry on using exactly the same scientific methodology as always. We test, construct, and develop theories in exactly the same kind of ways. But we slowly come to realize that the theory we've ended up with isn't a theory which admits a descriptive interpretation. It's not a theory we can take to be a realist one. And let's suppose that our arriving at this theory isn't due to some weakness of our minds. It's not that we've been insufficiently imaginative. It's not that we're lacking computational power. It's not that we're not doing good enough experiments. It's just the fact that we really hit the buffers. The world is precluding our getting any further. Appropriating Bell's felicitous phrase, the world is unspeakable at the fundamental level. There's just nothing descriptive that can be said about it in the standard kind of way. So we were trying to aim for realistic theories, trying as hard as we could, but we ended up with the theory, of course this is going to be quantum theory in the fable, which doesn't admit of an interpretation and understanding which is directly descriptive of the way the world is. And this is supposed to be a fundamental restriction.
Couldn't one make a distinction between being totally unspeakable at the fundamental level and
Yes. And we'll come back to that later. There's a couple of Wittgenstein quotes which are useful there. Should remind me if I don't give you them later. But in some substantive sense, the world is unspeakable at the fundamental level. So the world's not playing ball with us any longer. We want to try and describe it, but it's not apt for description in the kind of way that we want. We're not able to provide a complete dynamical theory, a set of laws describing the micro-constituents of the world and how they behave, how they evolve over time, and so on. Now, for the quantum Bayesian, this fable about what might have happened is actually not so fable at all. It's supposed to be fact. Okay, so quantum mechanics, on reflection, is supposed to be this theory which, much as we might have wanted a realistic theory, just isn't of that ilk. So the idea is that by looking at quantum mechanics, one's supposed to see that, you know, plainly, this isn't a theory that's realistically, that ought to be interpreted realistically. Any attempt to give it a realistic interpretation by way of hidden variables or by way of quantum state realism or so on is supposed to be just an unnatural mistake. Really, the face value of the theory is that it's a non-descriptive theory. Okay. But we ought to be realists, right? This is the this component here. We do desire theories that not only predict, but describe and explain. Clearly, our traditional realist project of providing a complete universal theory for the fundamental level of the world has been stymied. The world's not playing ball any longer. One could just give up on one's realism, but you could hang on to it instead and say that, well, given that the direct approach of describing the world has run into the buffers, we need to adopt an indirect approach to go any further. That's to say, we need to try and infer from the structure of the theory that we've been left with, a theory we grant to be non-descriptive. We need to infer from this theory, the fact that we have a theory of this form, what it is about the otherwise largely unspeakable fundamental world that gives rise to this theory as being the best one for dealing with the world. So what does the fact that this, quantum mechanics, is our fundamental theory tell us indirectly about the world at the basic level? The world at the basic level is indescribable. But we can, in the standard traditional realist sense, we can't have that kind of description of it. But nonetheless, we might be able to ferret out some important truths about this largely unspeakable world in virtue of the fact that quantum mechanics is the best theory for dealing with it. And that's the kind of angle on the reconstructed project that I take the quantum Bayesian to have. They're realists, scientific realists, who are facing up to the fact that the theory we've ended up with through our normal techniques of theory construction isn't a realist one. There is no replacement realist theory to be had, so what's the next best thing we can do? Try and find some indirect access on the unspeakable micro level. Okay. What follows if we take this approach? You get some easy stuff and you get some hard stuff. So the easy stuff that immediately follows is that the standard conceptual difficulties with quantum mechanics are dissolved. Now, they don't really arise in the first place. So there's no problem of measurement and there's no problem about non-locality. So this is pretty easily seen if we just think of a simple Wigner's friend scenario, a nice way of illustrating the standard measurement problem. So with Wigner's friend, of course, we have Wigner on the outside of the lab, his friend on the inside, friend's doing some interferometry experiment, and we're supposed to concern ourselves with what the right states, the quantum states for describing this are. And in a traditional kind of picture, the way Wigner, for example, set it up, Wigner's on the outside. He sees the lab, friend included, as just being a closed physical system. Such a system should evolve unitarily. So we're going to end up with a big superposition of the object system, the measuring apparatus, and its pointer states, and finally, the poor old friend who's looking at it is left in some kind of limbo. On the other hand, we have the view of the friend who actually sees something. So according to him, the system should be in some, a system and apparatus should be in some product state. And then there's the question of who's right. Is Wigner right, and this is an entangled mess, or is the friend right, and it's a nice clean product state? Now, in traditional approaches to the measurement problem, you're going to say something like, well, maybe there's a collapse at some point, and then the question is to say, when does the collapse occur? And that's going to tell you who's right, Wigner or Friend. But of course, on the quantum Bayesian approach, the whole issue only arises because of a kind of jejune literalism about the quantum formalism. We shouldn't take the states to be representative of facts about how the world is. They're just degrees of belief. So there's nothing inconsistent with Wigner having a degree of belief which corresponds to the entangled state for the system being measured, the apparatus, and the friend, and the friend having a different state for the system being measured and the apparatus. They're not in disagreement about anything worldly. So there, we don't have any problem about measurement.
What does that mean, not worldly?
What's your puzzle with it?
Okay,
so there's no fact, there's no mind-independent fact about how the world is about which they disagree. Okay. And a similar kind of story in the EPR type case. So here, of course, the standard worry is that entangled state, Alice does something over here, changes the state if there's collapse, changes the state of Bob over here. That's going to be instantaneous action at a distance. But again, on the quantum Bayesian view, that doesn't follow at all. All that happens when Alice does her measurement is that she updates her degrees of belief about Bob's system. That doesn't correspond to any physical change in Bob's system. He just keeps the same old mixed state for his side of the system. He's not wrong in keeping that. They can have different states for the same system because there's no fact for them there to disagree about. So we solve these problems in a neat kind of way. They don't really arise in the first place. The hard bit that follows is that one then actually needs to do the work of setting out on the foundational project and finding those structures in the otherwise unspeakable fundamental micro level that give rise to the quantum formalism. And of course, you know, the latest results on how far they've got with this kind of idea, you'll have heard the other day. So we get some easy stuff and we get some hard stuff. Okay, in a little bit more detail, how's the theory supposed to work? I want to set this out because we're going to eventually get to the question of what kind of ontology is supposed to be associated with this view. So there's a theory in which one talks about systems and their states and about boxes, which might be measuring apparatuses, or they might be just some kind of general time evolution, quantum gates or whatever. And we have operations. And finally, we have people. And the people are those who assign the states to the systems and the operations and POVM elements to the boxes. That's on the theory side. On the world side, the world is going to consist of smaller and larger systems, including ourselves, where the larger systems, the macroscopic level, the classical level, ourselves and our friends, are composed of the smaller ones. That's a simple enough, straightforward enough kind of view. But according to the view we're looking at the micro level, the world of the smaller systems, there aren't any laws governing the behavior of these items. However, at the macroscopic level, we know that there are approximate laws, roughly speaking. We can have pretty good true generalizations about how things behave. So at our level, we're able to describe things, we're able to utter truths about things. There are facts about tables and chairs and how they behave that we can have unproblematic access to. But at the micro level, where live the systems which compose the macroscopic objects, there are no laws. And so it's an interesting kind of question to ask about how this could be, how you could have at least good generalizations appearing at one level when there are no laws at the fundamental level. I think that does work out. And you might want to talk about that later on if it doesn't come up.
Sorry, I mean, so who's saying that there are micro level general laws? If it is?
Yeah.
If it's not okay.
Yeah.
All of them. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. But also bear in mind, so, I mean... Well, it depends on how many laws you think there might be. But what they need to be is not laws which are going to determine probabilities for the results of any measurement. So no modal fact can be implied by any of these laws. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, and this is why I'm doing some of the conceptual analysis of their position. Right. So this is my take on what Chris, Rüdiger, and Carl say. I may not catch. No. Go ahead.
So I think he's right. He never hears the word micro versus macro from that's probably true. You might have a problem here.
Yeah.
But this issue about laws, though, you hear from that one, all the darn laws, I can't. Yeah. But I'm not even sure that I'm attracted. I'm not sure I would say
there are
problems with the macro level.
Yeah, right. That's right. But I don't think you need to be so scared. I mean, I think we can have this stuff, and I think we actually need it. Going soft on this is very dangerous indeed. Right.
It's not infallible, but they're real.
Exactly. That's why it's dangerous going soft on it.
Yes. So Carl actually uses this to argue that Hamiltonians are real, even at the micro level. Yes.
That argument doesn't work.
Sorry?
That argument doesn't work.
Are you going to address that?
No, but I can now if you want.
So, the micro level, you can actually sort of see single atoms.
Well, that doesn't mean that there's a law governing them.
Well, you
and
know,
you're not seeing
a law
directly.
Governing my behavior. If I jump out of that window, it's going to be a big mistake.
Well, we're only on the ground floor.
So the
Hamilton. Coming back, let's keep that for the end, Marcus, and you can see where you're still worried. So, with respect to the Hamiltonian, so. If the quantum Bayesian doesn't think there's any fact about what the quantum state of a system is, it's actually irrelevant what its Hamiltonian is. Because we're not ever going to be interested in whether it's in its ground state, because there's no fact about whether it's in its ground state. We're not going to be interested in facts about the spectra of the Hamiltonian, because we never need to be in any of those particular energy states. We don't get being, as it were, hard on the Hamiltonian. Doesn't get you anywhere if you're soft on the states. That's the quick answer. But we may come back to this issue under the heading of explanation. What I'm trying to present is what I take to be the most defensible and conceptually integrated. Integrated? Is that what I want to say? The best interpretation of what the quantum Bayesian is trying to do. Okay. Now, concerning the micro-macro distinction, or the classical quantum divide, for all that Chris doesn't much like this terminology. Of course, one of the issues we always need to face when thinking about the quantum and classical is where the split between the two is supposed to come. And for many realistically minded people, this has always been very worrying. At the classical level, we have clear determinate matters of fact and can observe them directly. There's absolutely no problem, no funny business going on. When we come to the quantum level, it all gets a bit wavy and indistinct. Maybe we don't have any description at all of what's going on down there. Now, if one thinks that one can shift around the divide between the classical and the quantum willy-nilly, then we seem to have a rather worrying shift around in what we take is going on in the ontology. So, for example, if we suddenly start taking measuring devices and treating them quantum mechanically, or people and treating them quantum mechanically, suddenly it looks as if there are no facts about them, they've gone wavy and indistinct, or something of that ilk. So people get worried, rightly, I think, very often, that with a shifting quantum classical divide, one's playing too fast and loose with reality. Now, the quantum Bayesian does have a shiftiness in the... Oops, Bayesian. a shiftiness in the quantum classical divide. But their shifting is, I think, honest rather than genuinely shifty, surreptitious than that. And the reason is fundamentally that for them, the question of what gets treated classically, or rather what gets treated quantum mechanically, doesn't have ontological implications. That is to say, it's quite permissible to treat any macroscopic classical level, if you will, items about which there are mind-independent facts. You can treat that thing quantum mechanically if you want to. You can assign it a quantum state. Why might one want to do so? Well, one might be interested in details of the micro-macro kinds of interactions, and then you're going to want to model the whole thing quantum mechanically. Is that a question or is it a stretch?
No, that's
a stretch. Okay. But nothing precludes us, nothing precludes us from treating large-scale things about which there are determinate matters of fact quantum mechanically.
Is this the difference between the Bayesian and the Copenhagen? Because I suggest that the Copenhagen is just, already divided, but we can move it and we're not really going to talk about the same thing.
It's one important distinction. Yeah. So the pertinent question in the quantum Bayesian setting isn't what can we treat quantum mechanically, but rather what is it that we have to treat quantum mechanically. So we can treat classical level stuff. Classical level stuff has a bunch of unproblematic truths about them that we can state and state generalizations involving them unproblematically. But we do get to a level at some point, it's going to be vague no doubt, where that breaks down. We can't actually formulate decent statements about what properties systems have and what laws govern them. So when we get down to that realm, then we have to use quantum mechanics. There aren't speakable classical truths about them. Then we have to use quantum mechanics. But the mere fact that we describe something quantum mechanically doesn't entail that it's a system about which there are no speakable facts. So they can shift around unproblematically. And of course, again, part of the issue that's going on here is that because the quantum states don't correspond to facts about to objective facts about how the world is, it doesn't matter if different people treat the same systems differently. So one person might treat the measuring apparatus classically, another might treat it quantum mechanically. But it's not going to be the case that one's going to be right and one's going to be wrong about the joint probabilities for system measuring device measurements that one might do subsequently, because there's no fact which makes one set of probabilities right or wrong. Okay. So here's the claim again. A shift from a non-quantum to a quantum treatment of an object is not associated with any ontological shift. So we're not playing fast and loose here with reality. Yeah, it's rather inelegant, isn't it? It means, what systems do we have to use quantum mechanics to deal with? Not to describe, but to deal with. Okay, and here's an important corollary or component of that claim, which is that it's permissible, quite permissible, to assign non-classical superpositions to objects which one believes or knows there to be classical level facts about. Now that's quite surprising. That might well take a little while to get your head around. So here's one direction in which there's a connection. So if it's the case that I actually believe that there's some particular classical level fact about an object, so this could be the position of a pointer on a measuring apparatus, or it could be the center of mass of a table or something like this. If I believe that there's actually some particular fact about where the table is, then given standard views about how perception works and beliefs that I'm not actually going to make an error or something, I'm going to believe that when I look, I'm going to see the table just there. So if I believe there's a particular fact about where it is, I'm going to have a corresponding belief that I'll see it there. And accordingly, this quantum state I assign would be the one which gives the center of mass there. But the converse kind of reasoning doesn't work. Okay. So if I don't assign the table a definite, some particular quantum state, an eigenstate of the center of mass operator, if you will, it doesn't follow that I don't believe that there's a fact about where it's located. We tend to think it does because we so often surreptitiously have in mind the eigenstate-eigenvalue link, the idea that systems have determinate properties if and only if they're in eigenstates of some observable. But that belongs to a family of ways of thinking about the foundations of quantum mechanics, which is quite separate from what the quantum Bayesian is trying to do. They would wholeheartedly reject any such principle. So the mere fact that I assign some superposition of table center of mass locations to some object doesn't mean that I don't believe there's a definite classical level fact about where it is. And I don't even have to assign a convex combinations of projectors onto definite positions to the table. I can assign some genuine coherent superposition to it. Yeah, that's not a classical. That's not a classical fact, by definition. Because it goes wrong if you do that, that means that's something which needs to be treated purely quantum mechanically about which there aren't any speakable facts. Okay. So, to what extent is this a universal theory? Realists are traditionally interested in universal theories. They want to describe everything in the world all at once at a fundamental level. Now, clearly the view we have here is not, as it's sometimes called, a view from nowhere, a view which gives us the properties of the fundamental level of reality and tells us how they're going to change over time. We don't have a God's eye view of the universe provided by our quantum theory for quantum Bayesians. But there is a good sense in which it is a universal theory. That is to say, it can be applied to anything you might be interested in. But this is a piecewise application. You can't get everything all at once and treat it in a quantum mechanical way. But you can take any particular thing you're interested in, however large or small, and you can treat it quantum mechanically, and that will give you the best way of dealing with it. Okay. So what are the advantages of this kind of approach? Well, one, what I take to be a signal advantage is that it's the development of a common and often flawed line of thought to its logical conclusion. If you're tempted by this Copenhagen kind of idea that quantum states are somehow to do with cognitive states rather than states of the world, then I think the only satisfactory way to develop that view is by taking the quantum Bayesian's line. I think they've taken this idea to its logical conclusion. I think the only tenable way of developing this idea. Moreover, they're attempting to fill in a kind of unsatisfying lacuna that one often has when one is presented with non-realist readings of the quantum formalism. And the lacuna is this, right? Why is it that our fundamental theory has to be interpreted in a non-realist way? Right, the norm for a scientific theory is that they should be realist. They should be descriptive, and they should be hopefully universal and fundamental. So if we're convinced by somebody, or somebody just tells us that, no, quantum mechanics isn't like that, I think there's a good question to ask, well, why isn't it like that? Bohr, of course, waved his hands and said, oh, it's because of the finite size of the quantum of action, which induces a disturbance not to be forgotten about. That's too hand-wavy. What the quantum Bayesian project we can see as being is trying to fill in this lacuna and saying why we have to have a theory like quantum mechanics, which is to be interpreted in a non-realist fashion. So that's much more intellectually satisfying than just leaving it in the sort of lazy Bohrian state.
Let me get
that
somehow. So what exactly is the, lacuna?
Gap.
So what is the gap and how does it
Right, so, well, the Bayesians at least recognize the gap and hope to try and fill it. So one thing one could do if one's trying to interpret quantum mechanics is just say, if I were to interpret this theory realistically, it would behave very weirdly. So I should be an instrumentalist about it. I should take the theory not to describe what's in the world, but merely to be treated as an instrument for describing the results of measurement outcomes, sometimes called an operations kind of view. Now, given that the norm for scientific theories is that they, in fact, should be descriptive and explanatory, because we truly desire explanations, this is what we get into the business of science for, it should strike us as unsatisfying that our fundamental theory that we seem to have, quantum mechanics, isn't a realist theory, and just being told that one has to treat it instrumentally, well, maybe we do, but you know, tell me why we have to treat it like that. That's an unanswered question.
The question of why we have to do it?
Yeah.
Or just that we do have to do it?
No, it's why do we have to do it?
Okay.
And the completion of the quantum Bayesian reconstruction would fill in that gap. It would capture those facts about the fundamental physical facts about the world, which determine that we have to have this non-descriptive theory as our best means of dealing with the world. That's the idea. Too many people just wave their hands and adopt an instrumentalist or operationist interpretation of quantum mechanics.
So you mean, by that you mean the shut-up and calculate
time? Well, that's not so bad, because if you've got to do calculations, then you've got to do them. But insofar as that's supposed to be an interpretation, yeah.
Okay, I guess I'm just not... Well, we can talk about that.
Yeah. And the final point is that, of course, we get interesting new kinds of technical questions of the sort we heard about on Thursday. So I think these are salutary features of the approach. Now, here are the... Sorry, I'm taking far too long. Here are the putative cons of the approach. I don't take these to be good objections. They do often seem to be the first kinds of objections that people come to, but I don't think they hold water. So, as many people know, a good way of winding Chris Fuchs up is to say that his view is just a solipsist one. We saw that at lunch the other day. And Howard Wiseman is fond of doing this. Why should one think the quantum Bayesian view is a solipsist one? Well, it's all this emphasis on my beliefs about the world and not actually saying anything about what's in the world. And so, I mean, you know, if we have a rough picture, which, you know, intuitively speaking, we say, look, everything's made out of wave functions. Everything's made out of quantum states. But you're telling me that a quantum state is just a state of belief? So everything's just made out of beliefs? This would look like a form of solipsism of some kind. You know, there is no external world, there's only me and my beliefs, only me and my mental state. But I think we can pretty quickly see that this is an egregiously false charge. We said earlier that what the world contains for the quantum Bayesians are physical existing systems, the microsystems which compose the macrosystems. The macrosystems have statable facts about them. They have truths, mined independently. So, for all that one talks about quantum states in terms of beliefs, that doesn't mean that the classical level truths about them, there aren't classical level truths about the mind-independent world. So we clearly don't have a charge of solipsism holding. I mean, another way to put the point is that the quantum Bayesian position isn't a reductionist one. So it doesn't take the view. So reductionism in the philosophy of science is the idea. Theory reductionism is the idea that we're interested in explaining why one theory holds true. A theory at one level, say chemistry, holds true in virtue of truths at a more fundamental level, say the physics implying chemistry. And if we thought that quantum mechanics was supposed to provide a reduction base for higher level truths about the world, then we would be in trouble, right? Because what quantum mechanics is largely giving us is a story about operating with one's degrees of belief in a certain way. And that stuff clearly isn't going to give us a reduction base for classical level truths. You can't make mind-independent truths out of stuff about beliefs. So systems, it doesn't really mean anything to say a system is in a superposition. So there's a system. Yes. No, that's the point that whether one treats an item, the mere fact that one treats an item quantum mechanically, say giving it a superposition state, doesn't entail anything about the ontology of that system. So in particular, it doesn't entail that it's a system about which there aren't any stateable truths.
It seems like this can still be solved. If I'm crazy, I think what's actually going on here is a way we'll see in the
when I'm using common phrases to describe my work, I guess you need a rule for other common phrases to say it's crazy.
I'm not sure that that's right. I'm not sure that's right. So what are they going to... Well... The mere fact that people might have strange beliefs about things doesn't show that those things don't exist. And the mere fact that there may be no algorithm for forcing somebody to have the right beliefs about something doesn't prove that there aren't truths about what one ought to believe if one's not mad. Well, no, that means you're just, there would be a mind-independent world that exists out there. It's just that we're all lamentably unattached to it.
This is the ontological
state of the world. Oh, unequivocally, yes. We're just things in the world. The quantum Bayesian rejects the reductionist picture. Quantum mechanics isn't supposed to be a reduction base for higher level truth. And so the mere fact that we have lots of talk about degrees of belief at the quantum level doesn't mean that everything is made out of beliefs. Another kind of charge, a most peculiar one, is due to Amit Hagar, who says, well, look, this is just instrumentalism again. This is just the idea that scientific theories aren't descriptive and are just instruments for making predictions. This is curious as an objection to the position, because the quantum Bayesian is upfront right at the beginning saying, yes, I'm instrumentalist about the quantum state. I don't think the state describes features of the world. I do think the state and related structures are just about, that particular state is just about what one can see on measurement. But I don't think that it can be an objection to a position just to restate what one of its starting axioms is. And it's also just false that the general philosophical standpoint is an instrumentalist one. The general philosophical standpoint is a realist one where we're facing up to the fact that the world isn't playing ball anymore. Right? The world isn't permitting us. The world is too unruly at the fundamental level to permit us to formulate decent prescriptive laws about what's going on down there. That's a realist picture which is living up to the thought that the world isn't making life easy for us. So that just instrumentalism can be discounted. And finally, we have another curiously weak objection, which is the theory is just empirically refutable. And this is a Meir Hemmo has been inclined to make this kind of claim in the past. And the idea here is just that, well, look, it can't be right that everyone can just disagree unproblematically about what the results for, say, a joint measurement on system and apparatus should be. Because after all, you could do a measurement on the system and apparatus and see what probabilities we got out from doing that. And that would tell us, for example, whether Vignor or his friend were right about it. But this is just failing to recognize the fact that the quantum Bayesian denies that there are any facts which are empirically accessible which fix what the probabilities should be. This is just subjectivism about probability. If we take the subjectivist line consistently, then we're not going to be empirically refuted by purported facts about what the probabilities really are, because there's no way of accessing what the probabilities really are, because there are no such probabilities. These concerns can be discounted. Let's move on to the real concerns then. So I mentioned three. We'll probably have time for two of these. So the first concern, and one which exercised me for a long time, was the question, well, look, can we really make sense of this purported view of what the world is like? Can we really make sense of the idea that we have an unspeakable micro level on top of which kicked up on the surface of the sea, on top of which we have a level of determinate, statable facts. Now, I ended up convincing myself that in fact there are ontological packages which can make sense of this kind of view, particularly if one adopts certain components of Nancy Cartwright's philosophy of science. So we'll get to that in just a moment. But the kind of view that Chris wants to see for the quantum Bayesian ontology. I don't know to what extent Carl Caves and Rudiger Schacht share this view, the idea that really what we need to adopt is a pragmatist philosophy and the idea that the future is open in an interesting way. So pragmatism, for those who don't know this is a philosophical term of art. It's a network of ideas that are associated particularly with Peirce, Dewey, and James. Pragmatism is most usefully contrasted with the pragmatist theory of truth is most usefully contrasted with the correspondence theory of truth, which is by and large the standard way of thinking about truth. So a correspondence theorist of truth will say a statement is true if and only if it corresponds to the facts, where the facts are mind independent. The pragmatist will say, the correspondence theorist says there are these mind independent facts and something is true, a statement is true if it corresponds to them. And then we go out and we try and find these facts, and we do better or worse at that. The pragmatist says, no, the business of inquiry isn't independent of the question of whether something is true or false. So very roughly speaking, the idea is that rather than a theory or a statement being true because of the facts, and the theory working because it gets the facts right, it goes the other kind of way around. But if a theory works, then that means it's at least approximately true. And truth is brought about in part by our investigation into nature and our construction of theories about it. So here's a bunch of Chris's quotes. I presume he'd still want to stand by all these. So the quantum world is a world in continual creation. We have the idea that the future is open. There aren't currently facts about how the future will be. Something new really does come into the world when two bits of it are united. We capture the idea that something new arises by saying that physical law cannot go there. The individual outcomes of a quantum measurement is random and lawless. And this is the most pragmatist quote I think I found. There is no such thing as the universe in any completed and waiting to be discovered sense. That would be the correspondence theorist idea that there's a bunch of facts about how the world is, and we go out and find out about them. Rather, the universe as a whole is still under construction. Nothing is completed, even the very laws of physics. The idea is that they too are building up in precisely the way, and they're never the same danger of falling down as individual organic species, sort of a Darwinian idea coming in here. Now, what I take from this, the really crucial point that I take from this is the following. It's the idea that what happens, a singular concrete event, when a system and measuring device interact, is not determined by anything, not even probabilistically. And that's a crucial distinction between this kind of view we're looking at and any kind of, for example, hidden variable theory that one might seek. Because in any kind of hidden variable theory, you're precisely after facts, which either determinately fix what measurement you're going to see, or at least imply probabilities for it. But this view is different. It says there is absolutely no fact which is going to determine what the outcome is. There's no fact which is even going to determine what its probability is. Okay. Chris's reasons for wanting a pragmatist line rejecting correspondence theories of truth is not abstract philosophy. It's trying to make sense of quantum mechanics, where the most reasonable and simplest conclusion one can draw from Cauchy, Becker, and Bell is that unperformed measurements have no outcomes. The measurement provokes the truth value into existence. Now, I would rather be more philosophically conservative. I'm not an expert on pragmatism. I find it quite difficult to understand. So I'm inclined to stick with more familiar, conservative accounts of what the world is like metaphysically. And we can fit the quantum Bayesian's position into a more conservative picture. And this entails that, in fact, quantum mechanics isn't telling us that we need to believe in an open future or that we need to be a pragmatist about truth, even if we take quantum Bayesianism to be the right way of thinking about quantum mechanics. And here's the more conservative picture, which would allow us to capture the crucial point that I just mentioned that's going on in the quantum Bayesian's picture. So we can adopt an eternalist view. Eternalism is the view that all of the events in the space-time manifold are ontologically on a par. There's no ontological distinction of significance between past, present, and future. notions of past, present, and future are just relational terms indexed to goings-on at that point. And the crucial component of the eternalism is to recognize that facts aren't themselves temporal items. Facts are timeless. This is part of the logical character of facts. It's part of the distinction between facts and things, between facts and events. Things have locations, events have locations and times. Facts are timeless, logical distinct category. However, facts can timelessly pertain to particular times. So there's a bunch of truths about what happens at a particular time. Those truths are timelessly true, but they're talking about a particular time. Then what we need to capture the core components of the quantum Bayesian's picture is that the facts at any one time don't determine any facts about subsequent or even perhaps former times. So this is going to give us the idea that the measurement outcome isn't determined by anything. The measurement outcome is given by a factor, say time t1. There's no previous time which implies anything about what that outcome will be. That all makes sense in a correspondence, with a correspondence notion of truth. It all makes sense within a view in which there's no distinction, significant distinction between past and future events. Nick?
So, and for me, just for this is one of the things that I'm thinking about it. You're mentioning, you're talking about that one set of facts determining another set.
Yep.
Whether that's true or not. And I have a couple of questions. One of them is how does that show up if you're talking about a classical world being described by Bayesian thought? And the other is, I'm a little concerned because this statement sort of might lead to Coops to say, oh, this is where God is or something. This is where non-determinism is. And I don't really like that. I mean, what does determined mean if you can't actually talk, if you can't make actual predictions? It sounds like, what I'm saying is, it sounds like the notion of determination or determinism, as you're using it, is being spoken about as a fact. What causality
is something real? That's the kind of idea I have in mind. So the idea of determination is something like this. Do the facts at one time entail anything about facts at another time? Given what the facts are, do they imply anything about what facts at different times are?
I think they must.
Well, at some level, right, and this is going to be the emergent classical level at which we have good generalization solving true, but at the fundamental level, this isn't so. If you're trying to specify the character of all the events at the fundamental level, specify the events at the fundamental level in some way, there are no facts about those events, specifiable or not, specified by us or not, which entail anything about events at a different time.
So would you say that this shows that the world is not deterministic?
Well, it doesn't show it. I mean, it's an assumption.
So does that then that's even better. Does that assumption require that we have quantum theory, or could one make the same assumption reasonably even in classical?
I don't see any reason why one would make it if one had it classically, because there you have a theory we take to be apt to describe things in a way, such a way that the facts at one time do imply things about facts at another time. Yeah. Anyway, so this is my more, this may not sound terribly conservative, but I think this is a slightly more conservative ontological metaphysical picture than the kind of view that Christians prefer. I'm not saying we have to believe this, but this is a way I find it easier to think about it. So the kind of picture we're left then with is that we have a four-dimensional pattern of events where the events at one time neither determine nor imply probabilities for events at any earlier or later time. And crucially, this pattern is unruly in a certain very strong sense. It's too unruly to try and pull any laws out of. If you try and formulate generalizations concerning this pattern of events, you're not going to be able to manage it. One simply can't get laws out of this pattern at the fundamental level. That's another way of saying that the fundamental level is unspeakable. We can't gather enough coherence in what's going on to be able to formulate any interesting thoughts descriptive thoughts about it.
Have any way of saying anything? You say there are events, but do we even have any way of saying anything about events?
So it's yeah. So the status of events is a little bit tricky. I don't much like most philosophical theories of events anyway, so I just wanted to kind of avoid it. But one thing we can say is that we know we do have events. We know we have classical level goings on, which and there are truths about them. We also believe that the classical level stuff, the stuff about which there are statable truths, is composed of smaller things. So there must be events going on at the more microscopic level, which give rise to the higher level ones. So we can infer to the existence of the microscopic events, given the macroscopic ones and the idea of composition. What we can say about the, what we can say about character of particular events is going to be extremely limited. What we can say about the metaphysical nature of those events, one could probably adopt versions of any of the kind of standard philosophical views of events, none of which I much like, so I didn't really want to go into it.
I don't think it actually follows. I mean, you could have event microscopic without having small tiny events, like you have the microscopic temperature without the microscopic temperature for every molecule.
Sure. But, well, yeah, I mean, there's no requirement, maybe, as it were, same kind of event. But, I mean, temperature is no kind of event at all.
No, it's not an event. It's a property. It seems that it's a point like that, but it doesn't arise from a point like the behavior of the.
Well, if it's not an event, it's I don't see the relevance. Right, so something's change of temperature could be an event which took place over a certain length of time. There will be some story to be told about that in virtue of the microconstituents of the bodies and events involving those. That's
yeah,
the idea.
You wouldn't have to have a
temperature event, no, of course not.
Yeah.
There could be other, say, classical events that
are totally
classic
theory that would underlie that. Yeah. Let's see. How would we think of this, like a roiling mess of events? And here I think the most useful thing to do is move to a picture which already dumps the notion of law as important in fundamental physical theory. And this is the contentious, controversial claim of Nancy Cartwright. So Nancy Cartwright, quite irrespective of any concerns about quantum mechanics particularly, thinks that it's a general point of view about science that we shouldn't think in terms of what she calls a fundamentalist picture, in which you, in which there are laws which govern the behavior of things, and these laws hold universally and in the same way everywhere. She thinks instead what we need to focus on is certain modal properties of systems, largely speaking their powers or dispositions. And what happens is that in situations where, in fact, we do observe generalizations in which we do think laws hold, she thinks those are very special conditions of composition of systems, the powers and dispositions of different systems composing in a certain way and giving rise to these generalizations. But there's no universal holding of any law at all. We just have systems which might behave in this way, they might behave in that way, bring them together, they might behave in some other kind of way. But there's no universal pattern into which these goings on fit. We don't have a structure of laws fundamentally. Now, the normal way of explanation says that when we think about the dispositions of objects, say for example the disposition, fragility of a vase, its disposition to break when dropped, we normally think that we explain that in terms of the microconstituents of the device of the item in question and the laws that govern those microconstituents. But for Cartwright, the order of explanation goes the other way around. Fundamentally, we have certain modal properties of systems. And sometimes these will compose to give rise to law-like generalizations, but typically they won't. There's no universal cover of law. And this is just the kind of ontological picture which is entirely congenial, I think, to the kind of view I'm outlining for the quantum Bayesian. Because for them, there isn't any fundamental law en masse at the microscopic level. We just have, we're going to have the microscopic systems which have various dispositions to behave in certain ways, bring them together, something is going to happen. But what happens isn't fixed by any law at all. And the question of where events come out is then going to be a question of how what happens with the manifestation of those dispositions, effectively how, and then there might be different kinds of stories unfold about that. Okay, so I think that's an intelligible. Let's skip this one. I think that kind of ontology is intelligible, even if it's non-standard. I don't think we can accuse a quantum Bayesian of having a completely unintelligible story about how the world is, which one might have been worried about. Okay, this is the final. Perhaps I should have stopped. I've been going on for too long already.
This one has quite a long one for discussion.
How long have we got? 20 minutes.
Well, you're going on with it, you've got 20 minutes for discussion now.
Okay. Well, this one's very quick. Okay. So I think the question about ontology can be.
Yeah, you have to say anything bad.
Say something bad.
You've got to say something bad.
Okay, so here's something that worries me about this picture. So I thought the ontology was sufficiently worrying to rule this out of court. No, careful thought meant I think there could be an ontology which could go with this. But here's another kind of objection to the what I call the means ends objection. And it's a general requirement, I think, of any field of rational inquiry that there should be a match between the means of the inquiry and its ends. What are the ends of the quantum Bayesian? Well, fundamentally, they're realists. They want to find out how the world is, insofar as that's a possible thing. They also, of course, want to deal with what the world brings, and this is what they think quantum formalism allows us to do in the best manner possible. It's a pragmatic means for dealing with what the world, the unspeakable, unruly world, throws at us. So let's take this end as being the logically weaker one. What are the means? Well, the means for dealing well with what the world brings, with performing experiments and updating on the results. But now the question is, well, what's the connection between the means and the ends? That is, why should one bother performing experiments and why should one bother updating? We want to have an explanation of why it is that doing those things is actually going to lead us to deal better with what the world has to throw at us. Now, if one believes in some kind of objective notion of probability, then there's a simple answer to this. That you're, by updating your experiments, well, by doing the experiments and updating on the results, you're actually trying to track the extent to which, say, the current state of the world makes likely various other things to happen. You're interested in finding out, trying to move towards, finding out how much finding out what the probability is for future happenings is. But if we reject that objectivist picture of probabilities, it's left totally obscure why one should bother doing experiments and updating on the results at all. Because it's not as if one's actually tracking any facts about how likely some future event is in light of the current state of affairs. Now, a natural kind of response to this would be to say something like, well, it can just be a brute fact that some creatures, like ourselves, do this. Some of us go out, or our friends anyway, go out and perform experiments and update on the results. And it just turns out that people who live like that tend to live longer and better lives than people who don't bother opening their eyes. But this is just a brute fact. But saying that it's a brute fact is really to concede the point that there's this gap between, there's a question of, well, why is it that these people do better? We can say, well, we can understand why currently existing creatures do it, because if they didn't, they would have died out. But there's a question of why would they have died out, and why are the ones who didn't do it die out, and why are the ones who do it don't? In standard kind of Darwinian explanations, there's appeal to the objective notion of fitness, right? There's the extent to which the items actually fit for the environment they're in. But if there are no probabilities, then there's nothing which could define, as it were, the fitness of inquirers, those who do experiments. So if we're wholehearted about rejecting the idea of objective probability, then we can never explain why one ought to perform experiments and update on the results, it seems to me. Now, on the other hand, you might say, look, I just find the notion of objective probability so unintelligible that I see no option but to go the quantum Bayesian's route. But for people who are, as it were, undecided about where they ought to go, I think we need to recognize this gap between The explanatory gap between the means and the ends of the inquiry is quite a significant cost that the approach accrues that one wouldn't have on an objectivist notion of probability. So in some ways, that's just a general concern about subjectivism, about probabilities in the field of fundamental physics. Okay, we have the question of why is this a good thing to do? Okay, finally, sum up. So I hope I've explained why quantum Bayesianism is an interesting interpretive project, how it combines realism in general about physics with anti-realism about much of the structure of quantum mechanics, and how it dissolves some familiar kinds of problems that often worry us, problems about measurement, and I've argued that it manages the shifting split between the quantum and the classical level. It doesn't fall to common objections, an intelligible ontology could be found, but I think there are difficulties with subjective probabilities, and also in a somewhat related way with explanation, but I didn't get to talk about that. Okay, thanks for your patience, everyone.
Thanks. So first Wayne, then next Howard, and then I've lost count of the
people behind me. I just want to say something about the means and objection.
Yeah.
And actually, it's very similar to an argument in a recent paper by my colleague Bill Harper and some grad students on, I think it's called Why Bayesians Should Believe in Objective Chance or something
right.
like that. I would very much be, I would be very pleased if it were a objection to quantum Bayesianism, because I'm not a big fan of it, but I don't think it works.
Okay, good.
And because I don't think that they have
Harper's paper works.
I don't think Harper's paper works, and in fact,
does this argument work?
And I don't think this argument works for pretty much the same reasons.
Right.
Let me tell you why I don't think this argument works. Is so if the question is why we do go about doing experiments, at, you know, as a means of improving our feelings about the world. I think that the Bayesian answer to that one can be something like we don't need an explanation because there is actually a normative reason for doing that. There's a theorem due to IJ Good and then generalized for Brian Skerms is that if I have to make a decision and I have a choice of either making the decision given the information I have now or getting some information for free, updating on it, and then making the decision,
mm-hmm.
And I do an expected utility calculation about which I'd rather do, I can never strictly prefer doing it without the information. And if I have non-zero credence that getting the updating on the new information would change my mind, then getting the information has strictly higher expected utility.
Right.
So one way of saying that is a Bayesian is constrained to regard better informed credences as better.
Right, but then there's a question of whether that's actually rationally grounded. So you can say that within the setting of Bayesianism, it's rationally grounded, and you say, and right, and who gets to call that rationality?
So you're questioning whether maximizing expected utility is rational?
Well, so it's in the absence of objective probability.
Maximizing expected utility is not rational unless there's objective probability. I don't think you can.
Right. Yes. No. I don't want to quite. So what do I want to say? So what I'm trying to get is that way of putting things. Well, I mean, I'm aware of these proofs, so I've never actually read them, and I guess I should get around to doing that at some point. It doesn't seem to me that kind of explanation, as you say, it's a normative one in a certain sense. So it's not going, and I don't think it's a one that's going to have, as it were, descriptive implications. So the question is, why do those who do that live and others don't? You know, in the broader sense. And that's the question which there's no answer to. So those theorems don't give us any grip there. So yes, I shouldn't have said what I did. So it's not that it's irrational to maximize expected utility in the absence of objective chance. It's that we have no answer to the question of why maximizing expected utility, well, why why behaving in that way is a successful means of going ahead. But I mean, you're right, I need to think about the details here more carefully.
Okay, two quick things. One, you're never going to get information for free, so the premise is bad. But I don't actually want to get into that. What I wanted to ask was, can you briefly show at least the slide for number two?
For the explanation one.
Yeah.
So what I want to say here is that quantum mechanics is explanatory, and it typically seems many of its most fundamental interesting explanations seem to work in virtue of identifying the microconstituents of matter and saying what their properties are and saying how they behave. And then the trouble is to see how that could possibly work in a quantum Bayesian setting. So as it were, this is the flip side of the quantum Bayesian's non-reductionism. So it's all very well saying that, okay, I'm not going to postulate quantum states as describing physical features that bits of the world have, which then combine in certain ways to give rise to other kinds of phenomena that we can actually observe. Okay, so that's good in that it gets us out of, well, I mean, that's just a corollary of the content of the position. So that gets us into trouble when we try and give these, as it were, mechanical style explanations, which exist in quantum mechanics and really work, and explaining why matter is solid, explaining why some things conduct and others insulate and so on. You know, that goes in terms of identifying systems and giving their properties.
So the question is, if there are no microlaws, why do we have these explanations? Is that what you're saying?
Yep, pretty much. So if we just have these microsystems with modal properties, then if you want to say, well, why is matter solid fundamentally? It seems that all we can, if we can't appeal to the Schrodinger equation and say this is describing the laws governing the evolution of properties, all we can say is that these systems, proton and electron, have dispositions which, under certain circumstances, give rise to stable orbits. And that seems pretty close to a dormative virtue style explanation. You know, why does opium put you to sleep? Well, because it has a dormative virtue. Why is matter stable? Because it has a disposition to be stable. So, I mean, I don't take that to be utterly decisive against the quantum Bayesian, because they may have a different conception to offer of how these kinds of mechanical explanations are supposed to go. But that explanation isn't yet on the table, and it would need to be brought out to substantiate the approach, I think.
So that was
Yes.
But one point that I think might be sort of the key sticking point for me, right. I'm not so worried about the spacing of the game, because I sort of think maybe we would design the questions of the game. It doesn't worry me so much about the set of the probabilities of the macro. So the thing that worries me, I guess, is weaker spread. It's an idea of similar things. This idea that one can have, let's take a point of view, the Weaver spread is in a superposition.
Yep.
It says that I assign a superposition to my thread before I go to the lab and ask to work some experiment on this. And so I guess the idea is supposed to be, well, you know, this isn't stable in reality, therefore it's not a problem. But it seems to me that when you assign a superposition, you are making some sort of maybe dispositional statement about reality, about that system, namely that it has the power to exhibit interference and probably
in some sense,
whether that dispositional property is really there or not. And if you want to say, well, no, it's perfectly consistent with me believing he saw a definite result of that experiment, how is that consistent with saying there's some real sense in which I'm bothering to put this? Doesn't that commit me to thinking that there's some relevant experiment?
I didn't think that was me personally, but I agree with most of the rest of this viewpoint. Yeah, it's towards a view that at some sufficiently large levels, the large experiments, or when you get sufficiently large chunks of the universe evolve, tend to do when you get tangled with everything and you have to stop measuring and see how it works. That there really is, at some level, objective to coherence, or that the quantum view, that's a level at which maybe you're not trying to describe the whole universe, but the quantum view is already not valid, and it really has to be very fundamental.
Yeah.
It reflects the relational feature of the quantum universe.
I think the first bit of that, I'm not sure I followed the second bit so well, but the first bit of that I think is a good concern. I mean, of course, there's going to be an official line on this, right, which is going to be saying, there is no such disposition. Dispositional facts of that kind don't exist. So, and that's the right thing to say, if you're a quantum Bayesian, and you can legitimately say it, I think. Then there's a shadow worry which comes up even in the quantum Bayesian's position, right? So the worry would be, so I think there's definitely some classical fact about where the point is pointing. Why under some circumstances am I going to assign it a superposition, not a convex combination of point eigenstates, but a superposition of point eigenstates, and the worry is, why should I do that? I mean, that's the manner in which the worry enters for the quantum Bayesian. And so there's a loose answer, well, there's a general answer which would say, well, I do that because quantum mechanics tells me so. And you go, that's kind of a cheap answer. It might be true, but so why is it that we need to do that? What's the pertinent difference? What pertinent difference could there be between the case in which there's some classical level fact about it after all. So what could the pertinent difference be between the case in which I assign it the pointer eigenstate and which I assign it the superposition? Actually, maybe this does connect with your point about decoherence in a kind of way. The significant fact here is, of course, that at the classical level, measurements are non-disturbing, and that's probably partly a definition of this, what makes it the case that we can have stating truths in the large about lots of things. So I can't appeal to the idea that when I wheel up my measuring apparatus, I'm jiggling the thing, and that's what's going to give rise to the difference. It's just a matter, when it's a case of looking at macroscopic objects, then it is a revelation notion of measurement, not a creation notion of measurement. So where could the difference lie? Well, the fact is that we can only measure in, roughly speaking, the position basis at the classical level. So determinate pointer positions are positions in the position basis. So if I want to do a measurement which would display, as you say, interference between pointer eigenstates, I can't do that by doing a measurement in the rotated basis. I have to rotate the system and then do the measurement. And the thought would have to be that in that rotation of the system, some jiggling goes on which changes things. There's the sensitivity to touch which gives rise to the difference. So even though the classical level measurement is just revelatory, I think we can have a sense of what the difference would have to consist, why there could be sensibly a difference between the case in which one assigns a pointer eigenstate and in which one assigns a superposition of eigenstates.
We're just going down the queue that I've accumulated so far, and there's at least a time between the two. So maybe you have it first, and then Appleby, and then Alexei.
If you have time, you can come here. How does the Bayesian explain the great mystery that the past two centuries, the illusion of reality and objectivity?
It's not an illusion, that's why. It's fact. The world exists mind independently. Out there.
Well, but I mean, realism and belief in objectivity has been incredibly powerful.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's the fable at the beginning. This is exactly the norm. This is what one should aim for the very good reason that the world exists out there and we try and find out about it. It's just that when we try and get too finicky, the world starts jumping around and won't allow us to formulate laws regarding it.
Well, Yeah, but the question is, before we reach these offers, why has it worked so well before we...
Okay, good, right. So this is a good question. So how could it be that given the unruly micro level, we actually have an emergent level of good behavior? So there are different kinds of ways one might take that challenge. One could be just, you know, give me the story, you know, detailed story of how it goes. And there's a sense in which that's verboten, given this approach, because we don't have a descriptive micro-theory, so we don't have a bunch of statements which we could use to explain how the higher-level statements are true. So the idea, again, that reductionism is out of question. We need something weaker than reductionism. A favorite philosopher's term is supervenience. So supervenience is the idea that you might have one level of facts which entail some other facts, and any difference at this level of facts, the high level of facts, entails a difference at this level of facts, but not conversely. So the quantum Bayesian's picture is going to, it might appeal to supervenience. They might even say that supervenience fails. So a detailed story about how we have emergent good behavior isn't going to be had. It's not consistent with the thought behind the approach. But if the concern is it logically possible, is it conceptually possible to have good behavior, like laws, or maybe even exact laws, but more plausibly, naturally, and approximately true generalizations at the higher level, given the unruliness belief beneath. I mean, I was worried about this. I thought that, look, again, you know, this is a sticking point for this approach. Is it intelligible to have this? But a little thought and talking to some of my metaphysician friends convinced me that actually this was possible. So you could just have it as a brute fact that although at one level of description, well, one doesn't have description, there's just this unruly pattern of events, that the unruliness, as it were, washes out at the higher level and you just do get good behavior when you coarse grain. That could just be a brute fact.
Could it be that there's somewhere again different in there? Because most macroscopic systems are composed of many copies.
I mean, that might be a useful way of thinking about it. I was thinking more purely in abstract metaphysical terms. You know, is there a metaphysical conception of laws and properties which would allow this kind of behavior?
Could use an anthropic argument that we wouldn't even be here. I mean, our bodies are highly tuned to physical laws that exist. So if there were no structures to be manipulated or used, then there would be no one to even ask these questions.
That's true, but it's not necessarily going to tell dialectically for the quantum Bayesian, because it's not an explanation of why how it would work in the quantum Bayesian view. It's just a view that there's some view under which it works.
Yes, but it does say that if you're going to ask questions, you're going to have some order at the level at which you exist.
Yeah.
And so that grounds your previous comment, which just said that you can have the fluctuation wash out.
Yeah.
Because without that, it's like, well, why do they wash out? Well, it's like, they have to. If they didn't wash out, we wouldn't be asking questions.
Yeah.
I'm feeling guilty as the chairman because I excluded Alexi last time. So actually, I'm going to take our friendship as you'll allow me to do this.
Okay.
Why don't you ask the last question? Try to make it short, try to make it brief.
I had a shorter mark on Chris. It's just, Chris, it seems to me that you're assuming here this kind of linear epistemology, that in explanations have to go along the way sort of linear or in a linear fashion from things we assume to quantum mechanics to solids or conductivity, and so, which is not at all the only capable. There's no rule that says that this is how the logic of science is going to develop. So there can be a circular, but a consistent form. Our theories do not need to sort of keep one over another.
Right, but I got that point in the abstract, but my worry is that if you actually look at if you write one of these explanations out and say, yes, that exactly explains to me why we can have insulators. And if you look at what the explanation is, it just looks like a mechanical explanation. So what we need is, this is saying there are these things, they have these properties. It's because they have these properties that the periodic ion that opens up gaps and where does the Fermi surface lie. You know, it's attributing properties to stuff. And if you want to know why insulators exist, we're not interested in being told why various people might have come to have beliefs that certain properties would be insulating. We're actually just interested in why that these things exist. So it seems to me that the content of these explanations isn't happily straightforwardly set up.
You have a form of reductionist, which I don't think is a necessary, and it's possible, it's a possible stance, but I don't think it's the only one.
Right. No, I mean, so this is why I said the objection wasn't necessarily decisive, but I'd like to hear more about how it went.
Well, I think we should thank Chris again for that.